This episode of the Wired.co.uk podcast is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. Stay tuned for details of how to get a 10% discount. Coming up today, what the hell happened with this Flappy Bird controversy? Has the world gone mad? Plus, we discover a vast underground bomb shelter that has been reappropriated by urban farmers, and we look at care.data in depth. What is it? What do you need to know about it? And honestly, what needs to be done to improve it? All that and more coming up. This is the Wired.co.uk podcast, your weekly guide to the important and interesting from science and tech to flapping poultry and urban farming. I'm your host, Nate Langson. I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk.
I'm Olivia_Solon.
And I'm Leah Clark.
And I'm going to sound like a husky, sexy blues singer today because my throat is killing me.
You'll have a small window of husky sexy before you move into phlegmy.
It's on that fence at the moment, yeah. I'm just thinking, actually, Flappy Bird, it's not poultry, is it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Actually, you
think,
what kind?
Yeah, I don't think it is. It's a sort of anonymous bird. I don't think it's poultry.
Oh.
But anyway.
Why did I picture chickens?
Yeah, I immediately pictured chickens.
Well, chickens can't fly.
Yeah, but they flap.
That's why it was so shocking.
Well, true, but this one flies. Anyway, we're going to get to Flappy Bird in a bit because, man, has that been an interesting story to follow over the last few days. First, I wanted to make a little bit of an announcement or something of a reminder of announcement about our Wired Health event, which is getting very, very close. And it was pointed out to me that maybe we want to remind people that you can get a pretty big fat discount on our upcoming event that takes place at the end of April if you are booking before the end of February. Wired Health, we do a bunch of these events every year now. We do Wired Money, we do obviously our main event, Wired 2014 this year, we do Wired Next Generation, and the Wired Health one is a new one in our sort of events calendar, if you like, that focuses on healthcare, but also things like data-driven health, personalized medicine, genomics, synthetic biology, even 3D printing, bionics, robotics, neuromedicine, diseases, vaccines, all that sort of stuff. It's kind of everything you would need to know if you thought that your future was in the healthcare industry and how it's going to disrupt medicine globally. So we're hosting this event just towards the end of April, and there is a little opportunity still to get a 10% discount on tickets to this event, which really is looking to be fantastic. We've got some amazing people speaking at this year. People like Sir Mark Walpole, who's the chief scientific advisor to the government, Catherine Moore, who's senior director of medical research at Intuitive Surgical, Billy Boyle, who's co-founder of Alsto Nanotech, Claire Hooper, John Coates, Andrew Thompson, some seriously big names in medical fields. So this is taking place at the end of April. Specifically, it's on the 29th of April, and we have got a 10% discount for anyone who books before the end of February and a 15% discount for anyone who is a Wired magazine subscriber. So if you go to wiredevent.co.uk, you'll find all the names of people who are speaking there, further details, and obviously tickets to be booked. And we hope to see you there. Liv, Liat, and I will, of course, be there too, so we can have a nice conversation about health. Mm. But now, through my own ill health, it's time to do the news. So this week in the news, we couldn't really avoid talking about this because it's been something of a sensation. In fact, every so often a sensation actually sweeps across the gaming industry where an unlikely and previously unheard of little game explodes in popularity through nothing more than word of mouth virality, if you like. And this week, that game was Flappy Bird, which rose from obscurity to pretty much global app store domination, I would say, within days, and then was pulled from the iOS and Android app stores shortly after all this success kicked off. It sparked the creation of clones to fill the gap that Flappy Bird had left. It instigated a game creation jam session from other games developers seeking to honor the original title and support the one-man studio creator by in doing so. iPhones with Flappy Bird installed prior to its removal from app stores have been popping up on eBay with bids in the tens of thousands of dollars, and it was estimated that the guy who made the game was pulling in about $50,000, £30,000 every single day from ad revenue from a single ad that appeared in the menu of this free-to-download game. It has been ridiculous, and the daft thing is that the game is insanely simple. You tap a screen on the phone and a little bird flaps its wings and moves either up or down, and you avoid obstacles. It is about as simple as you can get. It's the kind of game you would develop if you were learning how to develop a game, and it's okay, we're going to make a nice, simple little you know, move the bird and avoid obstacles type game. It's that simple. But it has completely dominated the world's attention, I think, in the gaming world. Go on a tech site right now or a gaming website and find me a single site that hasn't written something about the craze that is Flappy Bird and the controversy that it sparked. Because basically, it was just an incredibly addictive game that got pulled. Why would you pull a game that is at the height of its popularity, that's on front page news around the world, that's making a ton of money, and you pull it?
Why,
publicity?
Mate?
I mean, we'll get to the conspiracy theories. But the it was created by a Taiwanese developer called Dong Nguyen. I'm not sure if that's how you pronounce his name, which we say a lot on this podcast, but that's how I've heard it pronounced. And he had said that, he'd said, quote, "Flappy Bird users, 22 hours from now, I will take Flappy Bird down. I cannot take this anymore. I can call Flappy Bird a success of mine, but it also ruins my simple life, so now I hate it." And he'd later gone on to say that he was worried that the game was too addictive, hence his decision. And this actually would tally, I think, with previous statement that he'd said that he, quote, "can't take it anymore," because reading reviews of the game really highlights feelings of users that suggest the game has driven people into madness. It's so hard, but it's so addictive. It's one of those games you can play and have defeat you in a matter of seconds. I when you start playing the game, it's very difficult to even get past the first obstacle, let alone several. So you spend the first hour just, you know, score zero, try again. I managed to get a score. I think my high score was 7, possibly 8. No one on my iPhone Game Center friends list has got into double figures. So a lot of people have got into sort of the 20s, 30s, 40s and things like that, but it's super, super difficult. I mean, it's just been such a craze.
Is this not like the best kind of marketing or PR coup in the world by, you know, doing the whole, it's like the way Apple always only supplies a limited number of its new products so that then it sells out and that creates this like frenzy of demand. Do you think he'll be re-emerging with a kind of a more expensive version in a couple of weeks' time after people have gone wild for the game?
He's said already that he will make more games.
Yeah.
And he's left his other existing games on the App Store. And as a result of the success of Flappy Bird, people have been looking at his other games. And so more of those, his other titles have risen up the charts as well. So yeah, I suspect that he will keep on making games, but I don't think this on his part is a PR stunt necessarily. Because if it is, it's ridiculous. You know, it's pulling down a game. It means you can't pay for it at all anymore.
Yeah.
It's not like doing something that raises, and then he said, okay, I'll put it back. He hasn't put it back, and he said he's not going to put it back, and I believe him.
But you think he's genuinely worried about other people's well-being despite really earning $50,000 a day?
I believe that's a part of it, but I have to say he's a one-man show. This is the thing when Apple talks about, and any app store operator talks about, is what's great about their services is that it allows people to develop a game, to publish a game, to get revenue for a game or any app, any tool, and not have to go through the typical processes that a big company would do, paying license fees for XYZ, all this sort of stuff. You can just make a game on your own and make success and money out of it. But what never gets highlighted is, well, what happens when your game gets to this extent of popularity, if you like? Sorry, it's a nasty sentence. It gets this popular. How do you manage customer support? Just looking at the App Store reviews for this, I mean, there are paragraphs of people like, this is driving me insane. I hate it. I think he's been getting like death threats for pulling it down. And it's crazy. It's driven people mad. And I kind of believe, well, to be honest, if I was doing this, like, how the hell do you support that? You can't. And I think that he's probably just totally unprepared for this level of attention, whether good or bad.
Yeah.
And the financial rewards as a result of that just isn't enough to offset the stress. So I don't know. It's a really sad end. But the number of clones now that have been popping up, I mean, I've had at least one press release a day over the last 3 or 4 days from some other person who's created another game with Flappy in the title.
Yeah.
You know, they are, and the App Store is dominated with Flappy This, Something Bird. They all look the same, just trying to cash in on this attention. It's crazy. We haven't seen anything like this for quite a long time. This level of popularity about things like maybe Angry Birds would have been, what is it with birds?
I know.
You know, Angry Birds, Cut the Rope, Doodle Jump, something like that. But they haven't had the controversy that's come along with this one because it's been pulled. You know,
yeah.
And I think that maybe what would have been a smarter move on his part would be to quickly sell it to somebody and maybe let them take it. You can imagine someone like Zynga or Gameloft or Chillingo or someone like that paying for the rights and saying, okay, look, have this, but he was obviously making so much money out of it that it wasn't the money he was bothered about. It was just his creation causing people stress. So the thing that no one really comments about is that Flappy Bird is awful. Like, yeah. it's a terrible game.
Surely this is just through sharing. Like, some of my friends were online going, I hate you, Lucy Abdullah, particularly because she had introduced people to it and said, beat my score. And that
but
was
I kind of
it.
Like it. It's like the Quop and Clop sort of games, the approach Quop, of making those incredibly difficult but simple. They're simple concepts but incredibly difficult, as opposed to making these games where you're kind of lured in to spend loads of time and then have these micro payments and you're, you know, I love this idea of just creating a really difficult game.
But Clop was quite different and quite unique.
Quop was
why?
Quop? Because it was, well, this is like avoiding obstacles is pretty, yeah, this was like the most ridiculous thing that looked so simple again, but it was a bit of a more,
but in terms
format.
Of it being hard to control, yeah. I think that's the same sort of principle.
It's a fairly common genre. There's a lot of games like that at the moment. Quop, that Liat mentioned, for anyone who doesn't know, is a game where you are a sprinting, like a marathon runner, but you have to control all his limbs independently.
Yeah.
It's Q, W, O, and P keys.
What was the unicorn one?
Clop.
Sorry. No, that was, yeah.
Clop was a sort of a spin-off, if you like, of Quop. And there's another one that's doing the rounds at the moment called Octodad, which is an octopus who's posing as a family man, but no one, he's trying to keep his identity as an octopus a secret, but you have to control all his individual tentacles. Ludicrously difficult. Have you been playing Flappy Bird and being driven into a sea of madness? podcast@wired.co.uk. Let us know your high score. We'll read out some of our favourites, maybe, unless they're higher than mine and I get jealous. Well, we might not be safe from bombs in our studio here. External noise, yes. Explosions, not so much. But Liv went to an actual bomb centre this week and found that it was populated by a lot of urban farming.
Yes.
Kind of Tom and Barbara Good in a bomb shelter in the 21st century sort of
Something
thing.
Something like that. Yeah, I mean, apparently there are loads of these things under London. I didn't actually realise how many there were, but one of them, there's two really long tunnels below Clapham, and they were used in World War II to house, they could house up to 8,000 people to, you know, and it's four floors below the Northern Line in London, which is incredible. But anyway, it's been taken over by some urban farmers who are growing salad vegetables there.
Quick primer, what's an urban farmer?
Urban farmer are people who are bringing agriculture into the city. I mean, it's fairly self-explanatory.
Sorry, just for the purposes of educating the audience.
Okay, sorry, I just thought it might make... Okay, yeah, but I think I just repeated the name in different words, so maybe it wasn't that helpful.
Same breath as vertical farming. I've heard of that as well.
Yeah, so that's the interesting thing. It was set up... the company's called Zero Carbon Food, and it was set up by two guys, Stephen Dring and Richard Ballard, who were just sick of seeing all these kind of utopian future studies, you know, where we see these vertical farms where they, you know, it feeds the whole population of these, you know, utopian cities, but no actual substance. No one was actually doing this. And so they looked into the idea of making these vertical farms, you know, taking up small amounts of space in cities to grow the produce that is required by the inhabitants of those cities, you know, reducing the amount of time and, you know, energy needed to bring that food into the city. However, as we all know, real estate in cities like London is extremely expensive. And so it would make absolutely no sense to have acres of land dedicated to growing salad vegetables. So they started looking underground, and someone told them about this huge network of tunnels under Clapham. So, and these tunnels haven't been used since the war. They've been, you know, they've had a few approaches from club promoters who've been keen to kind of have raves down there, but because of the lack of access, it's just like a long, long old winding staircase. They can't get the approval to have that. So, farming, on the other hand, it's perfect for.
Is it though? I mean, the complete lack of natural light.
So, well, hydroponic farming. Oh, that's okay. The difference. So you go down, and I went down this week, and it was incredible. So you're going down and down and down and down, way below the regular tube line, and then you get to this tunnel, and it's only lit initially by torches, and you're walking along. It's really creepy. It's kind of really freaks you out. But you can see a kind of glowing light at the end of one of the tunnels, and that is where they're doing a trial. And in there, they've got about, I think it's about five or six large hydroponic beds, which are sort of, they look like big tables, and on top of that, they've seeded, they place loads of seeds on it, and they're growing into plants, be it like rocket or cress or various different sort of salad-y type things. And above them are these LED lights, and that provides the photosynthesizing power of light.
So are they the only type of vegetables that could survive, you know, like small salad?
No, any vegetables could grow, but you're looking at ideally vegetables that have a high turnover, as in, I mean, grow very quickly,
yeah,
and that are don't take up a huge amount of space. Just, and these happen to be very trendy vegetables at the moment, like micro salads and micro herbs are very trendy. And they teamed up with a chef who, Michel Roux, who you may have heard of, and he is bang on board, because the idea that you can have vegetables arriving from growing, cut, and arriving on the table within the same day is pretty awesome, because normally that takes a couple of days.
It's amazing, and it's visually absolutely stunning. Liv's got some amazing photos as part of the write-up that she did for Wired at Kitty K. And if you're listening to this right now and sat on a computer, open a new tab in your browser, go to wired.co.uk, search for underground farmers, no, urban farmers.
Yeah.
And just look, even if you don't read the story, just have a look at some of these photos, because it is exactly as you would imagine. It looks like something out of the X-Files, frankly. It looks like they should be investigating alien corpses, not growing cress.
Yeah, apparently they've been offered loads of money to grow illegal plants in the underground tunnels, because it would be a perfect place to do so. But they want to go legit, and they're currently raising £300,000 in funds on the crowd equity site Crowdcube. And with that, they'll be able to ramp up production from their little small trial area into, I think they're going to have 10,000 square meters of growing space, which will involve like three tiers of beds along these huge, huge tunnels. So that'll be pretty awesome to see.
They must be paying next to nothing for this space as well, surely.
Well, there's just no, it can't really be used for anything else, because it's not a great place for lots of people to be down. So
they're going to make a killing, basically.
I don't know. I think that they'll make some money out of it.
They could certainly get away with doing a killing in that. It's not exactly accessible.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Well, if you're interested in this, wired.co.uk, search urban farmers. Do it immediately. The visuals alone will prove highly interesting. And the story is well worth a read, too. Nice one, Liv.
Thanks.
Liat, we're going to talk about talking therapy. Now, you had a story this week that says talking therapy, quote unquote, could help schizophrenic sufferers that refuse drugs.
Yes.
Now, we always approach these stories with a eyebrow raised higher than many topics that we cover. So what's the top line here? Is this is about schizophrenic sufferers not taking their drugs?
Yeah, and that is very key to understanding the study, because what the researchers don't want people to take away is, great, I don't have to take my drugs anymore. This is specifically targeting people that routinely fail to take their drugs. A lot of schizophrenia sufferers, they find, fail to take antipsychotics because either they forget or they just don't like the side effects, so which can be physical or things like emotional numbness.
I read one number that's about half.
Yeah.
Or more than that. I think stop taking them.
Yeah, commonly half. I think there was one study that was 74% of people stopped taking them. But the common number is about between 40 and 50%. So that's a huge number of people that are failing to take this medication.
So what's
really the only course of treatment.
So what did this study suggest?
So this was focusing on the benefits of cognitive therapy, commonly cognitive behavioural therapy, would be used. Now, it's kind of an interesting study because it's actually really tough to study individuals that don't like taking their medicine. They, more often than not, from quite a few of the professors I spoke to, don't trust medical institutions and, as a whole, you know, an uneasy taking part. But incredibly, with this study, almost everybody took part and took their whole course of cognitive therapy. And what they did was pit, they had 74 people in total took part, and they hadn't taken their medication for at least 6 months. Half of those people were given treatment as usual, which is basically they were given a prescription, but most likely did not take it. And the other half were given medication with cognitive therapy on top. And what they found was pretty incredible, I think.
Just to be clear, is this like CBT?
Yeah, exactly. Cognitive. It's like CBT. Cognitive therapy is like the catch-all for different types, and cognitive behavioural therapy is a subsection of cognitive therapy. So yeah, talking therapy, and which is kind of colloquially known as. So they found that, so that they measured them on a scale called the PNASS scale, I think it's called. And it was basically an interview to see if they still exhibited things like emotional withdrawal, poor rapport, delusion, hostility. And what you want is to have a lower score on this scale as you proceed through your treatment. And they found 41% of those receiving cognitive therapy improved by 50% versus just 3% in the other group.
Wow.
Who were
Wow.
only taking the drugs. So really, I mean, it seems really significant improvement. And apparently that is actually very similar to the results you get when you pit schizophrenia sufferers taking antipsychotics versus taking placebos. So it's not saying it's as good as taking the drugs, but it's having a real effect.
Surely it's about pairing the two together.
Absolutely. I think ultimately that is the kind of the key, well, not solution, that isn't a solution.
It's one approach. I mean, yeah. I suppose in that sense, it's like a number of sort of mood disorders, anxiety, depression, tends to be treated with a combination of antidepressants, anti-anxieties, things like
Absolutely.
That, and CBT, that sort of thing.
But I think the problem is that in practice, doctors are not pushing both equally.
Right.
Largely because of funding. There isn't a huge amount of funding on the kind of therapy side of things. And I think you find this with depression to do and anxiety. Doctors will straight away give you medication and not necessarily offer you other courses of treatment. And a couple of the professors I spoke to, they said, although UK NICE recommendations say you should offer medication and some kind of talking therapy, apparently only 10% actually are offered this additional therapy. And I think the main thing taken away from this study from people I spoke to was, I've now got clinical evidence for the first time. They've never done a trial like this ever before. I've now got the evidence to go to the NHS or to go to the funding bodies and say, you need to fund this. I need this in my department.
That's an incredible result.
Mm.
Fantastic. Well, look out for Liat's story on wired.co.uk. If you want to do a search for talking therapy, I suspect that will bring up Liat's full report, which obviously goes into more detail than we've discussed today. We're going to take a little ad break, but when we come back, we have one big discussion topic that you are not going to want to miss. It's about care.data. Basically, where are your medical records being stored? And shared and sold. This episode of the Wired.co.uk podcast is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create a professional website or online portfolio. Squarespace is still offering free domain names and customer website designs, drag-and-drop tools, and 24/7 support. And if you want to sell physical goods or digital downloads, such as music, or maybe podcasts or audiobooks, who knows, those are baked into every template, so you can start taking money right away on responsive website designs. And here's the good bit. You can start a free trial without putting in a credit card detail, and plans start from £5 a month. Whatever plan you go for, as a Wired.co.uk podcast listener, you get 10% off. That's quite nice, isn't it? If you use the offer code WIRED2. And that's because 2 is February, which is the month we are in. Go to squarespace.com/WiredUK, bash in WIRED2, and they'll know we sent you, and we thank you and them for their support. Welcome back. One section in this half of the show. We're going to talk about care.data in this week's segment. Oh no, they didn't. Controversy was afoot.
Yes.
This week.
Yes.
Because we wrote a lot about care.data.
You
wrote a lot about care.data. We published a lot. We learnt a lot. We told the world a lot. We thought it was worth summarising in 7 or 8 minutes what care.data is, what's happening with it, why it's so scary, what's not so scary about it. Go. So let's start the top. What is care.data? Why have we been paying such attention to it?
Okay, so it is an NHS initiative to share data that is currently stored in your GP surgeries in order to at least nominally deliver better healthcare services in England.
Okay, and normally it stays there, right?
Yeah, so at the moment, if you go and talk to your GP and all the stuff that you've told your GP over your lifetime, that data stays with your GP unless you give explicit consent for that to go somewhere else. And, you know, sometimes if you've ever had to use a health insurance, for example, the insurance company might request it. The GP asks you, you say yes, I consent to give my data. Well, care.data is a program that seeks to extract pretty much all of your medical records that are stored in the GP and store them in a central database, the Health and Social Care Information Centre, or HSCIC. And that data will then be used to try and improve the healthcare services that are provided. So, you know, which GPs might need more money for which kind of conditions that they're experiencing a lot of, where, you know, who's doing badly, who's doing well. And also use that data perhaps for medical research, pharmaceutical research, and potentially selling it on to third parties, which may or may not include insurance companies. So the main issue is that you don't really have a choice in the matter. They are doing this, whether GPs or whether you like it or not, thanks to a little law that was introduced in 2012 that you probably didn't hear about. There was very little public debate about it, and it was called the Health and Social Care Act. And in like point number 260 or so, there was a little clause that said if NHS England orders this information centre to tell GPs to give them information, they have to. They don't get a choice in the matter, and you don't get the opportunity to consent to it, which in my opinion is a bit of a breach of the patient-doctor relationship.
So we're telling a doctor something, they're logging it in one giant central database, and then it can be extracted from said database without our knowledge.
No, so you're telling your GP something, they're logging it on their databases, and then once a month that data will be extracted and put into the mothership of databases, and then third parties, the NHS, private companies will then be able to access that database and use it for various different purposes.
And is this personalised data? And what are we talking? Is it my height or is it my medical conditions?
It is.
Or both.
Lots of different things. It won't include your name and your exact address, but it will include things like your NHS number, which is a personal identifier, your date of birth, blood tests, any conditions you have, prescriptions, things like your body mass index, whether you smoke or not, any referrals to other doctors. So it's a really, really rich data set. Now, I would like to point out that the data relating to patients when they go into hospital has already been collected in this way. So if you've been to hospital a number of times in your life, or if you've had any social care, the data similar data has been collected already and will be in the central resource. So you might think, oh, okay, well then this is just joining that data together, allowing for a more complete picture of the patient, which in many ways is a great thing. And I think, you know, before we go in to criticize it too much, this is a phenomenally valuable resource for researchers. Like, this could provide an enormous data set to improve drugs and to improve healthcare services.
Absolutely. And there's a great deal of this that sounds extraordinarily modern.
Yeah.
In a way, I was registered at a GP surgery where they had a wall just full of all those paper documents.
Yeah.
And I thought, why am I staring at a wall of paper documents, medical records that could be burnt or stolen?
Yeah.
This does seem like a step in the right direction in that point. The question mark is over these insurance companies and the process rather than the actual thing that they're doing.
Yes, exactly. I think people feel like they haven't really been given a choice. I will come on to the fact that you can actually now opt out, but when this law was enacted in 2012, they don't actually have to give you the option of opting out from a legal perspective, even though you might feel, you know, it's morally objectionable to take this data.
That's only because they sidepassed a complete public consultation. I can't understand how something that seems to go into privacy issues so deeply could have not resulted in a huge public consultation.
Yeah. So let me just talk you through the main concerns that people have, because you know, Nate, you mentioned the idea of whether it's personal data or not.
Yeah.
It's kind of complex, but the data, although it doesn't have your name attached to it, there are some data that is personally identifiable, some that is supposedly pseudonymized, whereby they've taken out like some of the easier things to recognize you from, you know, your date of birth and your NHS number. And then there's kind of green data, which is generally seemed to be kind of safe data, which is like open data that you could release publicly and it would be extremely, extremely difficult to identify people from. But the main criticisms are, first of all, that the NHS is selling off your data, and indeed, the NHS will charge between £800 and £12,000, depending on what data set you want to access.
Well, is that a preventative measure to stop people thinking, oh, I'll just try and access this, in the same way they ramp prices up during rush hour to make people avoid unless they absolutely have to travel at that time?
Well, the NHS says this is a processing cost. That's just how much it costs for them to, you know, run kind of extractions on this huge data set, which may or may not be the case. Some people think that's very high, but the NHS says they're not allowed to really profit from this. So that's, I think we can kind of tick that off as they're not selling it off, but they are going to be charging a fee to access it. We can argue over the semantics, but
they're also vetting whoever gets the information.
I should think they bloody well are.
Well, actually, no, I think maybe they're not vetting all of them. Aren't they just vetting people that get it automatically?
They're vetting companies who want to access their data. Any company who needs to access that data has to sign a contract with the NHS. And in that contract, they have to state that they're not going to, for example, try and re-identify patients that are contained within that data set, which is another of the big concerns people have. People are worried that even if you don't have your name or your NHS number associated with data about you, if you say, you know, we have a pool of 100 people who have, you know, this condition, like, I don't know, 100 people in this GP surgery who have diabetes, and then 5 people who had an arm amputated. The pool of people who both have their arm amputated and, you know, diabetes gets smaller and smaller, to the point where if you have enough of these different facts about groups of people, you can kind of use a jigsaw attack to re-identify people, or to combine it with alternative data sources, you know, like the electoral roll or various things like that.
I think, though, I think probably less specific examples are probably equally true, though. I mean, I can't imagine, I don't know, I can't guess there are more than a few people at a given GP surgery who has had an arm removed and is diabetic.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, that's the point. So, yeah. The idea is that although it says, you know, it looks like a big group of people and it's been, you know, your name's been taken away from it, it can become quite easy to identify people. And so that's a concern. Although the NHS does say in the contract that you're not allowed to try and do that, but who's to say that, you know, a company might try and do that internally? How on earth would the Information Commissioner Office know?
Yeah, it might become a standard protocol for insurance companies every time someone makes a claim.
Well, they already
start investigating.
But we have this issue with the credit rating, is that it's basically invisible, and asking to know what your credit rating is degrades your credit rating because it looks like you've got something to be concerned about.
And you have
about.
To pay to access information which is about you. Which...
Actually, you don't. You can request it. It just takes forever.
Oh, really?
But you can pay to get it faster. But there's only 3 credit rating agencies, I think, and you don't know which one has your data about a given thing and you can't access it. It seems similar to that.
Yeah. So the 2 issues I mentioned so far, the NHS is selling off your data. We've kind of debunked that one. Secondly, that the NHS hasn't been clear about which organisations will be able to access the data. And so many people might be okay with the NHS using it to allocate resources appropriately, but what about pharmaceutical companies or insurance companies? And at the moment, the NHS is not being clear about who exactly is going to access it. They'll say they'll vet it, but they have a meeting in March to decide, you know, which companies they'll allow to access this data. Unfortunately, you have to opt out by March, so you don't currently know what you're opting out of necessarily.
Okay.
Thirdly, the idea that the data being stored centrally is vulnerable to a breach. Now, of course, GP IT systems are not immune from data breaches, but having all this data centrally might make it a bit more of a honeypot. And even if it's not hacked, there are always, you know, kind of the old leaving the suitcase on the train trick or kind of rogue employees who might be able to, you know, infiltrate.
The same goes for health data that the NHS already stores that is identifiable.
Yes, that's true. That's true. But this is just very, I think most people would say that their GP data is the richest sort of source of data that you could gain access to. And when that's, you know, if that's breached once, that affects the whole country as opposed to just your GP, your own GP. Not that that would make any difference to the individual, though. Mm. If it happens to you, it happens to you anyway.
But that's a tech solution. And I don't have a great deal of faith in a lot of government at the moment relating to... I mean, we for example, we saw recently with the, you know, Year of Code.
Yeah.
And the person in charge of that was very blasé about not knowing how to code and came out with a bunch of incredibly naive comments about coding and its usefulness and its ease of access and all this sort of stuff. And I think, well, your motives and your reasons are solid here.
Yeah.
But your decision to put somebody in place with those views and with that understanding, like if you're going into this with those beliefs, then what else is misguided in this creation?
Yeah, but that's an individual and that's politicians. No, it's not the engineers that are being hired.
I don't blame the individual person in question here. I actually think that, you know, she's a spokesperson for this entire program and that is the program's belief. She's just voicing that and I don't necessarily blame her as a person for that. It's just that's the understanding within government that this is the way things should work. That is not to me as serious as storing medical records, particularly with financial connotations like this. And it's those concerns that get me more worked up than just the fact that my medical data is stored in a central place, because frankly, the way we're going is towards eventually personalized medication.
Yeah.
And big data is could hold the key for lots of medical advancements over the next decade.
Yeah, but if you were asked, if it was an opt-in model and someone said, would you like to contribute in this way with your data? I genuinely think a lot of people would say yes.
I'd say
and it's the fact that we didn't have that option that that makes people feel a little bit uneasy about this.
And also, I think on the NHS's side, they've been... It's been a public service for decades. They have a lot of experience with dealing with, you know, huge, not to this extent, obviously, but they have a lot of experience in it. So I think it doesn't always come down to, you know, political problems with politicians not having the right belief system, because this is something that's quite ingrained anyway.
Yeah. But I think the final and I think the most important criticism, and this is probably the criticism that I think... Basically,
I think I know what's coming here. They've been really crap at communicating.
Yes, and I think this has completely undermined the entire initiative and the potential benefits that it could have. So you may or may not have received a little leaflet in the post. It looked like junk mail, and it was talking about the benefits of better information means better care. That was your notification that your data was going to be extracted from the GP every month and housed centrally. But most people would have chucked it away. Then I've spent a week trying to research this article to get to the bottom of how it works, what data they're actually taking, and how you opt out, and when you do opt out, what data you opt out of sharing. It's been a complete nightmare. I don't think I've ever found a single topic so challenging to get to grips with. And I spoke to many people in the NHS and they seemed to be completely ignorant to the fact that it was so hard to understand. And I was being directed back to their website FAQs, which weren't clear. That was the problem. And then I called up their helpline. They just pointed me back to the website. I found other documents, spreadsheets, like all tucked away on different microsites. And I pieced it all together. I spoke to the head of the whole project and I spoke to him for many hours. And even with that, it was really hard to understand what, if people could opt out, what they were opting out of.
Well, the good thing is that you did get to the bottom of it. And
yes.
The last 10 minutes of this discussion is a primer at best. There is so much to understand here. Liv, well, we've got a whole bunch of articles on wired.co.uk. If you search for care.data on the website, we've got a simple guide to what it is. Liv's written a great editorial piece about a lot of it to do with communication of the system, and a couple of other pieces as well that go into great detail. But we just want to leave with a couple of things. Firstly, Liv, because you are now the expert on this topic, do you think, as a top line answer, this is a good system that we should be thinking generally is a positive move, or something that we should be opposing?
I think it's a good idea, but we should be opposing the fact that it's happening with very little public debate.
Okay. And then the second question is, how do we opt out if somebody thinks, I don't trust this, I want to get out before the end of March?
Yeah, there are two opt-out levels. The first is opting out of having your data leave your GP. And that means no data relating to you will go out of the GP to the central database. The second option is saying that no data is allowed to leave the centralized database, so no third parties can access it. In order to do that, you need to either speak to your GP directly, or there are a number of forms that link from our website, which you can fill out and send to your GP so you don't have to call them up. And they will put a code against your medical records, and then your data will not be extracted in March.
Well, for more, go to wired.co.uk, search for care.data, and you'll find all of our articles that explain this in even more detail. But let us know what you think as well for next week's program, podcast@wired.co.uk, whether you're for this, against it, concerns you have, or any other comments about this topic. Okay, we've got a couple of pieces of feedback, quite controversial, one of them less so. Let's start quickly, I think, with Tom's, who wrote in to say, "Hi, Wired. Just writing to let you know I'll be signing up for the website that helps you with your afterlife," assuming you guys were talking about on a show a week or so ago. It says, "After being in a long-distance relationship, funny links, websites, and photos from the web are sent to each other quite a lot. If I died, I would like the idea of my friends to see something and think, Tom would be interested in that, and before you know it, it's been posted by me. Talking to an AI wouldn't work, but if an article was shared, the concept sounds a lot better. Don't we secretly all want to live forever?" I don't know. There's a lot of conversation about the first person to live for 1,000 years has already been born. That's not living forever, I suppose.
No. I like Tom's take on this, though. Sharing funny sites.
things
that you think your friends might like. Oh, that's quite a nice.
Quite sweet. I agree. Next one, Leah, why don't you read this out? This comes in from Carl, who's not our fan.
Yeah, this is tough to read, Carl. Dear Sir, Madam, this week's podcast was nothing more than ill-informed left-wing political commentary. It failed on content, impartiality, and delivery. Utter garbage. Don't bother with a reply. I've deleted from my iTunes the subscription and replaced it with CNET UK.
Boom. Oh dear. Aww. This is sad. So I think Carl was a bit pissed off about your probably conversation about David Cameron last week, if you're talking about left wing.
Well, he won't be able to hear this. We won't be able to hear the response.
Well, he just said don't reply. He never said don't read my email out on the air and have a conversation around it.
Oh, so no, I mean, he emailed it to podcast@wired.co.uk. It's obviously going to get read out.
Those are people who just want us to hear their views but don't necessarily want to hear them read back. Well, we're very sorry to hear that, Carl. However, CNET UK is a lovely show. I used to host it. My brother actually still does host it, so you're still going to get someone that sounds a lot like me, only less science talk. But hopefully you're still listening and you'll come back and be pleased with our conversations about this week's governmental topic. If you have a question or criticism of the show, and we do like criticism, actually. Like, criticism, the reason we read some of these emails out, like, criticism is a good thing. Constructive criticism is better, but criticism all the same is fine. Because if someone's highlighting a topic that we could be doing better or that we could better serve people, then that's good to know. So we do genuinely welcome people who think we're doing something wrong or that things we're doing right. So by all means, let us know what you think we could do to improve the show every week. podcast@wired.co.uk. Keep it nice, but keep it honest. That's all we ask for. podcast@wired.co.uk. Well, we're going to be back in another week's time with many more controversial topics. Hopefully, maybe we'll do one that doesn't talk about government policy and the intricacies therein. But we can't really promise because it seems to be a running theme. We'll see you then. Oh, and don't forget about Wired Health. wiredevent.co.uk. Find out. You're going to get a massive discount if you sign up before the end of February. So if you're listening to this now, check it out and come and join us and learn about the future of healthcare on the 29th of April. We'll see you next week.
Bye.
You've finished this week's episode of the wired.co.uk podcast. Until next week's episode, why not download the latest issue of Wired on your iPad, Android tablet or Kindle Fire? Do so with a discount from wired.co.uk/magazine.
You say it much more coolly than I did.
Yeah, I said it straight. I think it's good.
Yeah.
Oh, they so did not. Yeah. That would be a good one.